Who established civil government? Who set its purpose? What is its purpose? And what are its limits? We discuss this today on Principles and Policies. Hi, this is Chuck Michaelis. I'm your host here on Principles and Policies. We're going back to a series I did, oh gosh, has to be about a year ago. It was called the God and Government series. And I did three shows, and you can find those in the archives at principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. I will add from time to time to that series. This will be a part four. And yeah, there's a long distance in between. There's a lot of things going on. As you know, my broadcast partner was ill at the time, and I was doing these shows solo before his passing in July of 2023. And I'm still doing these shows solo, obviously. I do have guests from time to time. Some things in the news have kind of upset the apple cart here. And at least in my mind, there's a lot of very strange things going on, a lot of weird political alignments taking place. Ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't been paying attention, I'd be really shocked. But you all know about what happened on October 7th in Israel, and what has been happening in Israel and in Palestinian areas like Gaza since that time. And some of the things that are going on here, some of the backlash and the knee-jerk reactions, and now, of course, we have college protests, college campus protests. And those of us who are old enough to remember, I'm 67 years old. I still remember the college riots, the campus riots, and the race riots in the late 60s and early 70s. I remember very well what was happening in 1968, 1969, 70, 71, 72. We were in the middle of the Vietnam War, and there were a lot of campus protests, some of them violent, some of them relatively peaceful. Others went really, really bad, really, really fast. Right around this time, in fact, I'm recording this on Friday, May 3rd, 2024, for the Friday, May 4th, 2024 show. And it's ironic that we're bringing this up because would be 54 years ago. 54 years ago, May 4th, 1970, was the Kent State shooting. Some call it the May 4th massacre. It depends on your age and your how you express things and that kind of thing. It was the Kent State shooting where National Guardsmen opened up on rioting, opened up with rifles on rioting students who, at the time, the claim was made that these were nonviolent protests. They were not nonviolent. There was a lot going on. In other campuses, ROTC buildings would be burned down. University presidents' offices would be occupied for weeks at a time. And we're seeing echoes of that now. People are quote unquote occupying parts of campuses. Columbia comes to mind. Demanding that they be fed and that porta potties or some other method for them to do the necessary things that need to be done by human beings so that they can continue their occupation. They're demanding that they be provided with food and water, and but the one demand that I saw was they were demanding gluten-free, no bananas, and no nuts because of allergies. So here we are. We thought it was ridiculous in the 60s. And I remember in 1967, I was only 10. In 1970, I was 13 years old. But I remember it well because, you know, I was of draft age in 1975. Now, the Vietnam War ended as far as Americans. We pulled out by 1973. In 1973, I was 16 years old. But Saigon fell in April of 1975, and I graduated high school in 1975. But it looked, like I was going to, you know, there was a very strong possibility that we would still be involved in the Vietnam War. Now, remember, serious negotiations started about 1971 or so. And it really took off under the Nixon administration. So what we're seeing here is an echo of the past. And it's being done in much the same way as other things were done in the past. They're very often a lot of the quote unquote rioters or protesters, if you will, protesters and rioters. It depends on the reporting agency. If there's violence involved, there's a riot involved. For instance, the January 6th thing that went on was a riot. There's no other way around that. There was a riot at the Capitol on January 6th. Now, was it an insurrection? No, we've talked about this before. There are definitions to words, and this was nothing like an insurrection. An insurrection is an armed revolt with the sole purpose of seizing control of usually a capital city or something in order to seize control of government. That's an insurrection. If a bunch of people went in armed to Columbus, Ohio, and tried to occupy the state house for the purpose of doing a statewide junta against the government there and seized the governor and took control and threw them out of office, and that would be an insurrection. Same thing in D.C. That didn't happen in D.C. That there was a riot there, no doubt. And just like there were many riots actually since, none of which achieved the moniker insurrection. Why? Because two different I hate to say this, politically conservative people rioted on January 6th, politically liberal people rioted at other times, and nothing was done. Not even really an attempt to contain the riots. So I guess it's okay to riot if you're on the left side of the aisle, and it's not okay to riot when you're on the right side of the aisle. And by the way, one of those riots did include an occupation of government members, offices, and that kind of thing, which is exactly what the problem was on January 6th. So, you know, it's what's good for the goose is not good for the gander. Okay, why am I bringing all this up? Well, I'm bringing it up because one of the things that has disturbed me is a bill that got passed. I believe both the House and the Senate have passed it. Now, I can almost guarantee that Joe Biden will sign it. And it's a bill on restricting, really, the First Amendment, and which means it probably really won't pass constitutional muster. And some of the more conservative members of the House voted against it. Matt Gaetz, Boebler, I think Marjorie Taylor Greene, other members of Congress voted against it because they recognize it for what it is. It is a a restriction of freedom of speech and a restriction of freedom of thought. Is the purpose of the government to restrict speech and restrict thought? Now, you might say, we allow all kinds of things that really aren't to exist under the umbrella of freedom of speech. Things like pornography and those kinds of things are protected under the First Amendment, freedom of the press, that, and freedom of speech. What was all that about? Is pornography really free speech and free press? Well, the answer is, of course, no. It is a free speech and free press have to do with political and religious. Remember, the First Amendment also prohibits the establishment of a national religion. It does not prevent religions from having some say in government at all. What it does is it prevents the federal government from having any say in religion at all. In other words, the Founding Fathers, having lived through what they did, and remember, collective memories can be a long time. During the Protestant Reformation in England, there was actually a revolution fought, and two kings lost their thrones. One lost his head over religious, in large part, religious freedom. Charles I lost his head over a number of issues. Freedom of religion was one of them. Another one had to do with whether he had absolute power and authority, which is something we're going to talk about today. Let's see. James II lost his throne because he was going to try to force the Church of England to essentially dissolve into the Roman Catholic Church. And that did not fly in England. So he lost his throne in the Glorious Revolution, and William and Mary, William of Orange and Mary Stuart, who was the daughter of Charles II. But she was staunchly Protestant. Charles II was sort of wavering on his... He had married a Roman Catholic and was wavering on his stance as Protestant. Nonetheless, the real question here is that if you look at the British Royal Crest, even today, it still says... In the little scroll at the bottom, it says "Dieu et mon droit." It's French. I think it's French. It's French or Latin. Can't remember. I guess it's Latin. "Dieu et mon droit." What it means is "God and my right." In other words, I rule by divine right. And basically, because I rule by divine right, I rule as a surrogate for God. I'm in God's place and ruling. Well, is that true? Well, to a point, yes. Does that mean that anything you do is what God would do? Well, obviously not, since both Charles I and James II were deposed, partly because they were attempting to violate matters of conscience and do it on a large political scale. They weren't doing it on an individual scale. Okay, what I want to talk about is the limits that we're discussing. Does the federal government or the state government have the right to restrict freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion? And what that means is just that you can may practice any form of belief that you want. Can you can you do any kind of ritual that you would like? No, that does not what that means. I can think of a ridiculous scenario, and it's truly ridiculous, wherein, let's say somebody calls themselves a Neo-Mayan, if you know who the Mayans were in Mexico and Central America. They practiced human sacrifice. They people that were conquered and other people were taken up to the top of these giant pyramids, and their hearts would be cut out while they still beat, and the priest would hold the heart up as it still continued to spasm, and then throw the bodies down the steps of these huge pyramids. Huge, very steep pyramids. You can go down and climb the pyramids down in Mexico and visit those sites. Let's say there was such a thing as a Neo-Mayan, and believe it or not, such people exist. Now, are they promoting human sacrifice? No, but for the purposes of our discussion, we will say that they're promoting human sacrifice. Or the sacrifice of animals and those kinds of things. Are those restricted? Yes, they are. Why? Because they violate the rights of others, a human sacrifice especially. Now, you can make a point that abortion is a form of human sacrifice, people sacrificing infants to their economic needs, their career needs, their personal wants and needs. Now's not right time for me to have a baby, that kind of thing. You're sacrificing children to that. Okay, part of the reason why abortion should be banned, we've talked about that in the past as well. I'm an abolitionist, although I understand about medical treatment, and I'm not disparaging the fact that sometimes unborn infants die when mothers are treated. That's unavoidable. And that's not an abortion. That is a death of a human being under circumstances that could not be helped. So we live in an imperfect world. Okay, but let's go back to our Neo-Mayans who want to sacrifice human beings. Does this person have the right? I'll say it's someone who has wronged this person or something. Do we have the right? Do we bear the sword so that we can take the life of another person? No, there are limits to our right to worship our God, because those human beings who were sacrificed by the Mayans were sacrificed to their pagan gods. So, do we have the right, under freedom of religion, to do something like this? Or how about sacrificing goats and chickens and cows and those kinds of things? Well, the answer is, in certain circumstances, yes. Are you a legitimate church that is doing those kinds of sacrifices? Even Judaism, which is best known for doing sacrifice, doesn't have the sacrifice anymore. Now, would they like to start doing the sacrifice again? I think they would in some cases. There are very conservative Jews who would like to reinstitute. But where would they reinstitute it? They would reinstitute it in Jerusalem, where build a new temple, something along those lines, build a new temple, and then reinstitute the sacrifice. Do they have the right to do that? Well, in Israel, they very likely might. Here, it would be a little bit more sketchy whether that's covered by the First Amendment or not. In any case, the federal government could not restrict that, because remember that the First Amendment is a restriction. We've talked about this before as well, constitutional authority. Constitutional authority applies to the federal government. Now, under the incorporation doctrine, And you may not know what that is. You may know what that is. The incorporation doctrine is essentially says that all the rights contained in the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, all the things that are talked apply to the states as well as to the federal government. There's a major problem with that. It was never designed to be that way. The Constitution was designed to restrict the authority of the federal government, not restrict the authority of the state governments, unless it's specifically state and local governments, unless it's specifically noted in the Constitution explicitly, not implicitly. Okay. So the real question is, we go back to our original lessons that we talked through on civil government. And if you remember, we came up with four governments, right? Self-government, family government, church government, civil government, with the overarching government of God over all these. God rules over all those entities. So we've got self, family, church, and civil government, and they all have specific areas of function. You know, does church government function in areas of enforcing laws against murder, rape, kidnapping, robbery, those kinds of things? Does the church have the authority to punish evildoers in that particular realm? Only in one sense. The church has the authority to discipline individuals who are found guilty of these crimes. In other words, we're allowed to do things like, I'm a Presbyterian, and we have an excommunication procedure. Excommunication, there are different levels of punishment inside the Presbyterian Church. Other churches probably still have that in their rule books, but don't really practice it. We have methods of doing church discipline. Believe me, I've been involved in a couple trials. It's extremely unpleasant. You may think, oh, it's just you guys lording it over all these, you know, the people of your church. That's not it at all. We're maintaining the peace and purity of the church by punishing individuals who are disturbing it. And that would be thieves, murderers, kidnappers, those kinds of things. Yeah, in our case, we do it for adulterers, for people who are caught in fraud, lies, spreading rumors about other people, all kinds of different things, and they all have different levels of punishment. So, can the church punish those things that are normally civil government? Yeah, they can. Can the family? Well, obviously, if someone's a family member and they do these things, you can issue your own punishment, but it's nothing like the state can do, the civil government. So, the person who has failed to exercise their self-government faces the wrath of their family, their church, and finally the state. Now, can the state punish you for having evil thoughts or thinking badly about a person or a group of people or another religion or even branches of your own religion? Can you be punished by the civil government for that? That is not inside their bailiwick unless it turns violent. Unless you are espousing violence against these things, that is not the job of the civil government. Why? Because God has set the boundaries around the authority of that civil government. We have in America, we've kind of, and I'll talk this up to civics training. We have the idea that in the Constitution is a clause, and I'll give you the clause. The clause is contained in the 12th Amendment. If there was any question about where the limits of the federal government are. It's in the 12th Amendment. The 12th Amendment says, It's the 10th. The 12th has to do with federal elections, and we talked about the 12th Amendment here not too long ago. It's the 10th Amendment. I'm sorry. Misspeak. Here's what it says. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, and that's what all the preceding articles are about, nor prohibited by it to the states. Remember, states maintain a lot of authority under this Constitution. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. In other words, if the power is not explicitly given in the Constitution to the federal government, it is reserved for the states and for the local governments and for the people. That should be very clear from this. Now, what has the federal government been doing? It's been very busily trying to usurp state and local and personal authority away and making it a matter of federal hegemony. There's another amendment that goes right with it, and that's the 9th. It's very important. You understand these two together. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. In other words, you can't just go through and say, well, you can't create rights. And you can't create, and you can't disparage rights that the people have. You can't just go around and say, well, we're the federal government. We're reclaiming that right. That doesn't work. Okay. All this to say, there are limits to the federal government recognized by the founders when they put together this Constitution. Remember, there was another one before this called the Articles of Confederation. And it did much the same thing. It had flaws in it, which is why how we got the Constitution. We won't go into that. Each state also is required basically to have a constitution. What does that mean? It's a piece of paper that outlaws the rights and responsibilities of the state and the rights and responsibilities of the local governments and of the people governed by those entities. And unfortunately, the Constitution is what's called a negative law. It sounds bad, but it's not. It's the best kind of law, negative law. It basically says you can do anything. You can do anything. We as individuals and states can do anything except what's prohibited to it, to the states and to the people, and given to the federal government. That's a negative law. In other words, the federal government is not permitted to do anything other than what's laid out in the Constitution. The Ohio Constitution, I can tell you, is this weird, complex document. It's positive law, meaning that it basically says that the government can do anything they want except the things that are restricted here. That's not a way of looking at civil government at all. It's not the way we should be. We should be looking at civil government as something that's there to protect us. That's the purpose and function of government. Now, it's definitely the purpose. The function is now kind of messed up. We can see that by looking at things like this, this recent anti-Semitism bill. Now, look, I'm not saying I'm all for anti-Semitism at all. That's not the point. I find anti-Semitism to be repugnant. It's an ugly hate that Christians and non-Christians should not have. And yet we can see it being manifested out there in these college riots. This isn't just about opposing what the government of Israel is doing, and that there's always legitimacy in opposing something that governments that are, you know, you can argue about whether Israel's response to the October 7th attacks are just or not. That's not what these are about. These people are trying to get the U.S. government to come out and declare that, and also university administration for some reason, but they want them to declare that the Jews are evil because of these things that are going on in Gaza. And they want them to be legally restricted. I'm sure that, although if you look, we've all seen the interviews. And if you haven't seen them, just look around. You can find the interviews where people go and ask these rioters, protesters, what exactly they're asking for. And there are slogans involved. The one slogan you'll see is Palestine should be free from the river to the sea. And people don't really understand what that means. That means that Israel itself would be wiped off the map. If you don't get that, then you can't possibly have looked at a map of the Middle East lately. Because, and it's very obvious, by the way, that these protesters and rioters haven't looked at a map. Because I have seen interviewers that go just individually pull the people out. What river and what sea? And you get the look of complete confusion. Not all of them. Some of them know full well. Especially the professional protesters who are brought in, by the way, there's a lot of those out there, rabble rousers, who are being paid by someone, probably, through dark money. Remember, we gave Iran, billions of dollars, that never should have been done. And they're using it to fund things like sending rabble rousers to the United States to stir up college campuses. But anyway, we go back to this. They'll ask the question, what river and what sea? I mean, when you get an answer, there you will get sea answers like, I don't really know, and I don't really fully understand the situation there. So what are you doing out in a protest? Well, I'm just in support. I don't like massacres going on in Gaza. So you're okay with the one that went on in Israel? Well, I don't know that much about it. That's what you hear. What river and what sea? Well, some of them, I heard one actually say, now I'm not saying this is a majority or this is all of them. What I'm saying is this is the level of understanding of the situation before you go out and engage in a protest and a riot and or a riot. The one answer I saw was the Euphrates and the Black Sea. The Euphrates and the Black Sea. Folks, that's essentially like Iraq and Turkey. It's not really that close to Israel. The river and the sea involved is the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. And a large number, far too many, don't really know that. Why? Because they're uninformed. Why? Because people are telling them, and in some cases, I think we'll find out at some point, that college professors were giving extra credit for going out and being involved in a protest. Wouldn't be the first time. College professors were giving extra credit for showing up at things like conservative speakers and heckling them. They were given extra credit for heckling conservative speech. What's the problem with this? Well, the problem is this is a undermining of the idea of freedom of speech. You know, we've lived in eras where things got this bad before, where free speech was, people would be heckled and they would be assaulted, they would be insulted for simply saying certain things. Around the time of what we call the Civil War, incorrectly called the Civil War, the war between the states, the war for Southern independence, any number of names. Around this time, in the years before this popped up, people's speech was severely restricted. You could not make speeches and have debate on certain topics in certain parts of the country, both North and South. And during this time, in the late 1850s and in the early 1860s, right up until the beginning of the Civil War, the war between the states, you could not have a debate, an honest debate on slavery in northern states or southern states. And not about just slavery, because the Civil War was not just fought about slavery. It was definitely one of the things that was in the mix. But it was more about economics and constitutional interpretation. Okay, let's go back. That's not really the subject here. We have riots going on. And we have definite expressions of anti-Semitic thought. It's hatred of the Jews. Open hatred of the Jews. Now, we've had open hatred of Islam as well. And it's interesting that this bill that's being passed is specifically about anti-Semitic speech. Do I think anti-Semitic speech is a good thing? No. But do I think it should be allowed? Of course. It's an expression of a thought. If you attempt to restrict speech, you are restricting thought. Do I think it's a good thought? No. I think it's a dangerous thought. But it's not my job to make sure that you don't think that way, except perhaps by the art of persuasion. And that's one thing we have lost in this country. We have lost the idea that we should win arguments by the power of our persuasion and our logic and the truth of our arguments. And if that doesn't work, then we use the coercive power of the government to get it done. That's not in the realm of the civil government. That's not in the realm of the state governments. That's not in the realm of local governments. There was a years ago in the 70s, I think, there were Nazis, real honest to goodness American Nazis, American Nazi Party, and they wanted to do a march through Skokie, Illinois. And they applied for permits, and they were denied permits. Why? Because Skokie, Illinois is largely a Jewish suburb of Chicago. Why would the Nazis want to march through Skokie, Illinois? Obviously, they wanted to stir trouble. They wanted to stir trouble. Do you really think that people, many of whom had relatives, or some of whom were probably Holocaust survivors, why would they want to allow this expression of thought in their locality? Well, obviously, you could start a riot. I mean, these are fighting words and hate speech. Should hate speech be restricted by local governments and by state governments within extreme bounds? Should I be allowed to go into Dearborn, Michigan and make anti-Islamic statements? No, in public. Now, if I'm discussing something with someone and we were discussing problems with Islam and those kinds of things, that's one thing. But these laws that are restricting anti-Semitic speech are far too broad. They're going with a far too broad definitions of anti-Semitism. Being critical of Israel and being critical of people who are Jewish is not anti-Semitism. It's being critical of individuals and nations. Now, if I come out and say, it's typical of all Jews to do this, that, or another thing, that's anti-Semitism. Now, we all know that different groups of people have different sort of characteristics. They're caricatures, they're stereotypes, but they're stereotypes and caricatures because there's at least a modicum of truth in them. Is that being anti-Irish? Is that being anti-German? Is that being anti-Hungarian? Is that being anti-Chinese? No, it's acknowledging that sometimes these things have a modicum of truth. If you take that and apply it to all Chinese, all Irish, all Germans, all Hungarians, all Africans, if you do that, all, you know, name an ethnic group, you are guilty of racism or name the culture. Yes, you are. Because you're assuming that everyone has that characteristic. That is wrong. It's a sin. Should that kind of speech in public be outlawed? Can you outlaw the thought? Well, these laws are an attempt to outlaw thoughts. This is a major problem. You cannot outlaw thought. Again, you need to persuade people by argumentation. You need to persuade people by logic. You need to persuade people by being winsome. Not by doing these things. Now, in Skokie, Illinois, if I recall, it's been a long, long, long time. I think the federal courts ruled that they had to allow that these Nazis do this march through Skokie. In any case, the Nazis were actually permitted to march and then they didn't do it. The Supreme Court, I think, ruled incorrectly. I think Skokie had the right to restrict that on the basis that it could start a riot. It's hate speech. It's that kind of thing. Okay, that's a local government. Remember, we're talking about the federal government. Now what the Supreme Court did was it usurped local authority in saying that, no, Skokie couldn't restrict that. I think Skokie could restrict that under the original intent of the Constitution. Okay. Because we're talking about scopes and limits and that kind of thing. We know from our previous three shows that we did, our previous three forays into those four governments, you know, self, family, church, and civil, that all those governments are established by God. All of them. Civil government is an establishment by God. Remember, as populations grew, there wouldn't have been much need for civil government. For instance, when it was Adam and Eve and their kids. Really, it's family government. However, as you started to grow and you started to see more important things happening, and we're all aware of Cain and Abel, this suddenly comes out of the realm of the family government, because what's the family going to do? The only thing the family can do is try Cain and sentence him to some punishment. That suddenly is the foundation of a civil government. Now, did that happen? No. Who tried and convicted and sentenced Cain? God did. But remember, it's not too far down. What did Cain do? He realizes that he's being thrown out of his connection with his family, and he goes out and he begins to found cities and things. And remember, we're discussing things that happened. We won't get into the details, but cities implies that civil governments have to be founded. Why? Who else is going to punish things like theft, things like murder, things like kidnapping, things like rape, things, all these things that human beings do to one another? Who's going to punish that? Is it going to be left up to mobs of families to fight it out in the streets? Nobody thinks that's a good plan. Nobody. Everybody understands the need to have justice determined and punishment issued by an authority who can look at it from a neutral perspective. Because as far as certain family lynch mobs and things, you think about justice when you leave it up to family justice and there really isn't a civil authority. That's how you end up with things like the mob. If you look at that, the mafia exists, the mob, not just the mafia, but all kinds of different mobs, exist outside of the authority. They've set up a shadow government. Because when, if you think about it, Al Capone and Bugs Moran, what were they fighting over? The beer market. What was wrong with that? The selling beer was illegal. So they were, could they go to court to dispute the illegalities that they're engaging in? Well, no, they can't. They're outside the civil authority. By going to court, they'd have to admit that they were breaking the law. So they've set up a shadow government to deal with it. And how'd they deal with it? They threw hand grenades. They had machine guns. They killed each other in public and private places. They beat each other's heads in. They did all kinds of things. And then they went through and corrupted the political process as well, so that the politicians and the governments would look the other way while these things went on. That's when the civil government has overrun its authority and people, these kinds of things happen. Okay, so the civil authorities came about because the population grew and you couldn't let people fight it out on a family to family or block to block. We see these things in places. I can still remember seeing gang wars in Miami. Again, gang wars. They are setting up their own shadow civil governments. Okay. So it should be evident that we as creatures have no authority or power to dictate or to establish the requirements of civil government. Who's done that? God has. We didn't form civil governments because we thought it was a good idea. God gave them to us as a gift. Sometimes we don't look at it that way, as a gift. It's a gift to keep order. And because God has establishment, he established it with a set of parameters and boundaries. And civil authority should not extend beyond the requirements set by God. This means that the state is not to operate in the areas of the family, school, or church. In other words, there are defined boundaries for these, and we discussed that earlier when we talked about what can a church do if they've got someone. Well, they have a very limited authority. The family has a very limited authority, and the state has a very limited authority, the civil government. If the Bible doesn't make a provision for the powers involved, in fact, it set up protections. In the Old Testament, There were things set up in the Old Testament in Israel when they went into the land. They set up sanctuary cities. What was a sanctuary city? If you had accidentally killed someone, any number of things, farm accident, accidentally running over them with a cart, names, some weird thing, a tool malfunctioned and killed someone, you could go to these sanctuary cities and have sanctuary against family members who wanted to seek you out and kill you for revenge. This was a way of being protected against being a victim of revenge. Now, God understood that he had not fully empowered the civil governments yet, but he did do it in these sanctuary cities. So as God makes us understand what it is that he wants us to do with civil authority, he set up places where people could go to feel at least somewhat safe. If you went outside the boundaries of the sanctuary city, unfortunately, you could be fair game for these revenge murders. Now, would it still be a murder? Yeah, it would be. And you'd be subject to a trial on the basis by the civil authority. Where did the civil authorities rule? They ruled in the gates of the city. That's why you'll hear very, very often biblical references to someone being in the gates. They're in the gates. In fact, the Institute for Principled Policy, when it existed, put out a magazine called In the Gates, and we did it irregularly. I still have copies of the old In the Gates, where we talked about these issues. We discussed Romans 13. We discussed the authority of the civil government. We discussed the church authority, those kinds of things. So we were thinking about that as a think tank way back in the early 2000s. A lot of people think that, and again, this is a failure of civil education, a lot of people think that government has authority because they say they have authority. In other words, they declare themselves the boss, forgetting where civil authority comes from and declaring themselves to have absolute authority. And that you'll see that right now in the civil government and in the state government that kind of lords it over sometimes the local governments, telling what they can and can't do. And a lot of it has to do with revenue and that kind of thing. Now, the reason God has split this all up into realms, if you will, the self, family, civil, or a church and civil governments. Why? He wants these powers to be separated. This is kind of why in our own federal system, which is based on a Presbyterian system, we have separations of powers and separations of authorities. He wants things not to be centralized in one location. God demands that we decentralize government. Because once you put it in the hands of a centralized authority, bad things begin to happen. You get bad people who seize control of the reins of government in certain areas. They usurp power. Usurpation means you assume the authority that someone else has. And this becomes a nightmare. But if you separate these powers out and say you can't jump from here to there to another place. Now, for instance, self-government and family government, each member of a family is a self-governed individual, or should be. That's the whole point of training up children. You want them to become a self-governed individual. Okay? Now, each one of those members of a family who is self-governed and is a member of a family is also involved in the church government. self-governed individuals and members of families then serve in their churches as self-governed individuals and as members of families, which is why, you know, for instance, our church does family worship. Why? We want our kids to be in the service, learn to sit and listen to the lesson, and we're there to help them understand and train them up so that our self-governed individual in the family and in the church and members of the church as self-governed individuals and individuals who are members of a family and of a church then serve in civil government. Again, we'll go back to the idea of being in the gates. Did they just allow anybody to sit in the gate? No. That person had a specific set of talents and abilities. He was self-governed. He was the member of a family, usually the head of the family, and he was a member of the governing, you know, he was a member of the church. He went regularly to the worship services, to synagogue and to temple, to sacrifices and that kind of thing. And then he sat in the gates as a self-governed individual member of a family in a church. Now, granted, we're stretching church because it expresses an idea, but they didn't have a church per se. They had synagogues where you went to study the Word of God on Sabbath, and you attended sacrifices on specific times of the year, sacrifices and feasts and those kinds of things. But nonetheless, that person, if he was not an upstanding member, not a self-governed individual, and not an upstanding member of a family or in the synagogue, did not sit in the gates. That was if you read the Proverbs 31 description of the Proverbs 31 woman, what does it talk about? It talks about a woman whose husband sits in the gates. She is part of a family. She contributes to the family. She helps raise the family. She helps support the family with the things that she does in the marketplace. Is this talking about specific people? No, it's not. It's talking about the ideal. So, again, self-governed individuals, families, churches, synagogues, if you will, and civil government. That is how it's supposed to be split up. Can the civil government come in and tell the family what they're allowed to do and not allowed to do in regarding raising their children to be self-governed individuals? No. Can the church do that? The church can make suggestions, and the church trains the adults to help. If you've ever been to a baptism in a Presbyterian church, the congregation is asked, not always, but part of the ceremony is to ask if they will pledge to help the parents raise the children in the admonitions of the Lord, in the fear and admonition of the Lord. That's the way it's done. There's a reason for that. The reason for that is God recognizes that, yes, we have to be self-governed and we have to be in these family units, but we also need help doing that. That's why these powers are split up. So the church has some authority. Remember, they have disciplinary authority if they recognize that something is not being done in a godly and biblical manner. That is the duty of the church. Is that the duty of the federal government? That's way outside their jurisdiction. Unless the parents are doing something like abusing their children. Well, abusing their kids. I can't think of anything else. I mean, everything else I thought about is abuse. So we have to think in terms of limitations, jurisdictions, and when we're talking about the purpose and the function of civil governments, we have to understand where it is we're going. Well, look, I'm out of time. I didn't get anywhere near where I wanted to get. At least we understand that there are jurisdictions and there's reasons for that, and they're God-given. So I know I will have said some controversial things. That's fine. I want to hear back from you. My email is vicechairman@principledpolicy.com. That's vicechairman@principledpolicy.com. And you know what I think, and I want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And please join me again next week for another Principles and Policies.